Welcome to season two of the Ohana Life podcast. Last year, I tried to give you information and guests that would help you along a wellness journey so that you felt more empowered with your decision-making on health, wellness, everything related to, you know, yourself and your human body. This year, I wanted to have a different focus where we went over more how to feel empowered in learning, how you could, you know, get somebody that maybe gelled with your beliefs or what your goals were for physical strength or mental strength, and then be able to seek out and search that learning, because really learning can be at any age. In this episode, I was able to chat with Kaya Mindlin. She lives yoga in every way: her lifestyle, studies, how she raises her children, her relationship with her husband, friends, and community, as well as how she makes herself in service to others with knowledge that may not be as accessible or as easily understood by others. She lives in California and was kind enough to fit this in between her very busy schedule. I feel that she is key in helping us with our ongoing education. We talked about how to find a teacher, using discernment, having a healthy student-teacher relationship, and teaching on purpose. She even gave a nice description of what dharma means. It was a very simple conversation, but covered some important topics in depth. I really did enjoy the simplicity of it and going a bit deeper in a more relaxed way. Kaya is a delight, and we're lucky to have this conversation recorded for you all. Just a reminder that we did do a podcast together in season one. It will be linked in the episode notes as well as her website and programs. I do hope you enjoy and get something out of this and have the best day. I love you all. Welcome, Kaya.
Hi, so nice to be with you, Lisa.
I know. Thank you for doing this. We had you last season, and it's so nice to do this again and take a different take on everything we went over.
Mm, yeah, sounds good.
So, if people want to listen to the prior one, I'll definitely have that linked in the notes, so that won't be a problem. And that was more like, you know, your lifestyle trying to be a yogi with a family.
Yes.
Through that. That was very fun, actually.
That was fun and different for me. It was definitely one of the more personal interviews that I did. So it's really a sweet one.
It was sweet. So I'll link that for sure. So you have a lot of online programs and courses, plus you studied under, or maybe still do, a guru or teacher. Maybe you can tell us what you call it. And your knowledge is just direct and concise. So you come from a place of having a direct teacher. And then you're still one of the few that have read the ancient texts, dissected them, had someone to kind of bounce questions off of. I don't think there's a lot more people left like that. So you have that kind of coming at us. And then I really wanted to approach this conversation today, talking to someone who's had this journey of beginning the studies and where you are today, kind of where to begin, how it works, how to find a good teacher and so on, and then how to preserve the teachings, especially when it seems difficult. So I know for me, I love learning stuff that pertains directly to me as a person and my relationship with others, because it's a very felt experience. So with that, little bit of history with you, maybe give us a little bit of your history of where you started with your teacher and multiple teachers.
Sure. So, I'll just interject a little bit with some of the things you said, just to kind of clarify a little bit. you know, there certainly are. First of all, I haven't read all of the texts and dissected them. What my experience has been of learning what people call texts, the Sanskrit word is shastra, which just means texts and teachings. The way that I received those teachings is in the context of the teacher-student relationship. So I had the teachings that you can find, that much of which you can find written, I had those teachings unpacked for me by my teachers, explained, they dissected, and I received, right? And then I then applied those teachings in my life and returned to them again and again, and returned to my teachers and mentors and gurus again and again to keep growing into those teachings and extracting more of that nectar over time, you know, through the relationship with the teachers and through the application of those teachings in my life, my relationships, and my own work as a teacher. So it's not like I sat down and read a bunch of books. I just want to say that. And then also, I appreciate the lovely, you know, compliment about being one of the few teachers that, you know, has a certain relationship with these kinds of teachings and teaches them in a particular way. But I'm certainly not, you know, one of a few. I think I'm one of, you know, many, many, particularly if you look within the culture that yoga came from. If you look to India, of course, my experience is not uncommon. But I think what's different is that if you look to yoga land, it is more rare to have someone that has had a healthy teacher-student relationship, an authentic teacher-student relationship, and the blessing from the teacher to teach some of the things that I teach. I'm absolutely not the only one. I have wonderful, beautiful colleagues that do similar work, but we're more rare in yoga land, and it doesn't get as much maybe of a spotlight, which is okay.
So how did you find your teacher?
Sure. So I have had in my life, I have two primary, what we can call gurus. And I'm happy to differentiate, you know, some of the language. So I have two primary gurus who I found through teachers. So I had over the course of many years, 12, 15 years or so, I had some primary teachers in my life. An asana teacher, multiple Ayurveda teachers, a Vedic astrology and Vastu teacher, and so on. These teachers had teachers, right? And so over time, I was able to connect to some of the big gurus who were the gurus of my teachers. And so one of those gurus is Pujya Swami Dayananda Saraswati. And the other is Krishan Mantri. And I was able to spend some time with both of those teachers and get their blessing to teach myself. And that was, you know, wonderful. And they have both since left the body. So I continue now to have some teachers and mentors who were students of those teachers.
So are they, would they be considered disciples?
Yes, disciple could be a word that would be used for sure. You know, the Sanskrit, we have the word guru, and then the student is called the shishya. And a shishya is someone who is a true seeker of the knowledge that the guru has to offer. And so guru-shishya relationship, you know, is how we would call it in Sanskrit. And then the shishya, some of the shishyas, the seekers who are students of a guru, they also become teachers or mentors or advisors or counselors or something in some way, using that knowledge with their students. And this is often referred to in English as lineage. And it's through those relationships that teachings and practices are shared authentically and unpacked. So, yeah.
So you found these teachers through other teachers, and they aren't in the physical body anymore.
Right.
And I feel like, are there many gurus left that are like the old gurus of India? No, really. You know, I feel like there's far and few of those.
Right. So, you know, guru can be taken in a lot of, in a few different ways. The word essentially means the one who removes darkness. So one who has the capacity to remove that which is covering up or concealing the truth of yourself within. So guru can also be used a little bit more casually as teacher, but technically guru means this big guru as you're referring to it. And they have always been, in a way, rare. Because when we're talking about a guru, you're talking about someone who not only has mastery over a subject, but they have self-mastery as well. They are utterly free from any personal agenda whatsoever. No self-interest, no self-concern at all. Agenda-free and self-mastery, in addition to mastery over a subject and the capacity to help others gain mastery over a subject and self-mastery over time. So they have the inner experience and they have the capacity to help others, you know, gain that inner experience over time as well. That's a big guru. They do exist, for sure. But then the question is, I think, why are we asking the question? Right? So why are we looking for a guru, or why do we want to know that? I think then we go back to, well, why we seek yoga or yogic knowledge and yogic practices at all is because we are suffering in some way. We want our suffering to be alleviated, and we are seeking something that is more than what we've sought in the past. Right? So in the past, I knew I was suffering in some way, or I had some discomfort or feeling of insufficiency or inadequacy. And so I sought the perfect job or the perfect spouse or the perfect home or more money or more success or more fun experiences. And I keep realizing that none of these satisfy me completely. I'm still in some way feeling insufficient, inadequate, dissatisfied. And so I'm still seeking. So why we look for what we might call a guru is because we want the suffering to be alleviated, and we want the satisfaction that we're really seeking, a more permanent, deep sense of inner satisfaction. So we seek a guru, but we can also alleviate our suffering and start to gain a sense of inner satisfaction that comes through inner maturation and growth through a relationship with a teacher, a mentor, someone who is a few steps ahead of us in that process, someone who they themselves has a guru. So I think more important than the title or the classification is looking at, well, what am I really seeking? I'm seeking to lift my suffering away. I'm seeking to have a deeper sense of satisfaction. Is there a teacher that I can connect with who will help me, who will meet me where I am right now and help me with that human quest, which we can call a spiritual quest, a human quest, a life quest. And I think it's more important to go deep with a teacher and teachings and practices that resonate with us. And sometimes that teacher has the title of teacher. Sometimes they have the title of guru. Sometimes they have the title of mentor. The title is somewhat immaterial. Those words have meanings, but it's more about what's resonant for me. Who am I connecting to? What's available to me? Because I've worked with some people that have spent years seeking the perfect guru, the perfect title, the perfect personality, body, you know, location, that's some idea in their mind, and they kind of never find it. And some of these people have a teacher sitting right in front of them, but it didn't fit their idea of what a guru looks like or what a guru is. And then often they end up finding someone who looks like that idea, but isn't actually in service to the teachings, free from agenda in the way that I'm talking about. So to me, more important is, who am I connecting with? Are they ethical? What are they sharing? Is it authentic? Does it help me in my quest? And if it's helping you and all of those other things, you know, those other boxes, so to speak, are checked, then I go for that. And gurus will, you know, big gurus will come into your life through those those teachers.
How would one begin to start the process of seeking a teacher? Should they list out all of their ideals first? Or should they list out what they're seeking first?
Well, I think let's go back to how do you even know you're looking for a teacher? I think most people that, let's say you're listening to this conversation, how did you end up listening to this conversation? You probably have a teacher or a friend that connected you to this conversation. So I would go with, what am I connected to currently and where will that lead me? So, and then I would ask around, you know, people do a lot of research before they choose a surgeon, right? Even a plastic surgeon, something for the, you know, superficial layer of the body, nothing wrong in it, but how much research we do before we pick a surgeon, because we know that it matters. And even more so, let's say it's a heart surgeon or something like that. So with a teacher, we should do some research. We should ask around, ask friends, ask teachers that we currently have in our lives. Who are your teachers, or who do you recommend? Or this is what I'm suffering with. Do you know someone who has tools, teachings, or practices that could help alleviate this? So that you really go into, what is it that I want, and who do I know that might know someone who can help with this? You know, word of mouth essentially is what I'm talking about. And then if a few suggestions are made, you look into those people. You see if they have some content that you can access so you can see what they're about. Does their teaching style resonate with? Do the practices and teachings they're sharing resonate and help me? And then you read their bio. You know, if their bio is about everything they have accomplished or their own personal journey, but says nothing about where they learned what they learned, has no sign of reverence, then I would be out of there. You know, so you're looking for, what are they offering? Does it resonate? Can it help me? Were they recommended by someone I trust? And then do they show signs of reverence and authenticity?
So, and I think too, it's probably okay to try somebody and then maybe it doesn't work and you go to another person. You don't have to commit
absolutely
right away immediately to somebody.
Yeah. It's just one foot in front of the other, like so many things in life. And then it's up to, you know, luck and karma and
it is luck. Timing. I feel like it's luck.
Yes. And timing. You know, I have students that say, oh, I wish I met you, you know, this much earlier in my life, or, you know, at this, you know, 3 years ago before I went down this other rabbit hole. And I say, but you wouldn't have been ready. Mm-hmm. And I maybe wouldn't have been ready. The timing is as it is, as it's meant to be. Certainly we want to protect people as much as possible from getting into a dangerous or manipulative situation or bad, you know, teacher-student relationship and so on. But we're each on our journey, and it's like finding the right life partner. It's a little bit of effort and a little bit of luck and timing. like any important relationship in our life, you can't force it to happen. And often, you know, many people with a life partner will see that, you know what, they didn't look the way I thought they would look. And I don't just mean that in the superficial, you know, you can't just make a list and then wait for them to manifest. Right. It's like, we're not in control.
Like kissing some frogs to find the prince type of.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Sometimes that's how it is.
So I like the idea of the steps, right? Like, what is it that you are looking for in your life? And then seeking that out by conversations with other people, or listing the things that you want to learn. Right. And then having conversations with people, right? Like those might be two good steps, starting steps.
Yes, really. I stick with the first one because, you know, we can really get in our heads and be over analytical and idealize. You know, I've had people come to me and say, well, I want to read the Upanishads. Where should I start? Or I want to read the Vedas. Where should I start? Or I want to accomplish this pose. Where should I start? And then I come back and say, wait, hold on a minute, slow down. Why do you want that? So there's some outside list, you know, or I heard from so-and-so. It's a should, where it's a shoulding on yourself, as they say, kind of a thing. Instead of, usually it's what's really at the heart of it is, as I said, I'm suffering with something or I'm dealing with something. Then I heard that maybe this pose will help me or this text will help me. But you don't know that that's true. So it's really more being about, what do I want help with? And then find the teacher and they will tell you what will help you.
I almost feel like we should have somebody else tell us what's wrong with us.
Well,
what to seek.
That's also often something that a teacher or a mentor or a guru does, either by directly pointing it out, saying, you know, I know you think that this is what's the problem, but it's actually this other underlying thing. You know, many people that have seen, say, an Ayurvedic practitioner or an acupuncturist can kind of relate to that. You go in thinking, I have back pain and that's my problem. And then they say, well, actually, it's a deeper imbalance and the back pain is a symptom. But at least the symptom brought you to a practitioner that can help you get to the root cause. So it's okay to start with what you think the problem is.
Okay.
And then the teacher or the mentor or the teachings themselves will help resolve it without you ever even knowing what it was sometimes, or see deeper into what's the underlying root cause. And, you know, then there's people who are teachers, you know, yoga teachers, and they do want to know, well, I want to study this. I want to learn this. But even then I say, why?
Yeah.
Because you should. Because you're adding it to your list of accomplishments, or because you're a teacher and you're serving a certain population and you understand that they need you to know this. That's a deeper reason. And I think when you're the reason behind you're seeking a teacher or a teaching is coming from a personal place, then you'll find a teacher who will resonate at that level instead of just give you information that doesn't change anything.
Now, the gurus and teachers that have been on a path much, you know, longer than I have, that I've encountered throughout my time, have a very tough love. Is almost like a parent, but maybe even a little bit more. I mean, what do you think that's necessary? I mean, I do, but like you said, the acupuncturist will be like, well, it's actually something different. Do you feel that that's necessary?
It's so funny. So there's a lot to unpack there, right? So it could be that it's the kind of teacher that you have the karma to have a connection to. That's just what...
there's nicer ones out there? No.
So there are teachers that are very sweet. I mean, I'll talk about the tough love thing, but I also think it's interesting to say, you know, well, the teachers that I have encountered are this way. Well, maybe that's the teachers you've encountered. Maybe that's the kind of teacher that you need, or maybe it's the kind of teacher that you're attracted to when you don't even realize that that's what's happening, or maybe that's what you see. And then if it's a personal relationship where you actually are interacting with them directly and not just like watching videos or it's something to the masses or something, then it's maybe that the teacher sees that that's what you need. And so that's what they're giving you, because teachers who are agenda free will adapt according to the timing, the circumstance, what's needed in the moment, the student, and so on. So sometimes that's going on. But in my experience, there are the teachers that are soft and mushy and sweet and sugary and all lovey on the outside. And then on the inside, they're strict and a little bit harsh and very serious and tough love. And then there are the teachers that are on the outside. They have a very firm, kind of harsh exterior. That's their delivery mechanism. But then on the inside, what's driving that sternness, that harshness, is a love. It's like, don't you get it? You know, time is limited. Life is precious. Let's get the point now because I love you. You know, so there is something there where often, yes, many of the teachers that I have had as well have had a degree of intensity, of harshness, of fire, and that's part of their delivery system and because they're taking it seriously. And sometimes the way that I put it is the teacher, and I think this is anyone who is a teacher should aspire to, the teacher is not concerned about being liked.
Yes. Yes.
Right? Because they are free from self-interest and self-concern. And that's not just gurus, that's even a yoga teacher. When you walk into that room to teach, at least for that hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, for that time, you be agenda free. You be free from the psychological dependency on being liked or getting something for yourself. And so then if what's needed is that you be a little more firm, then you will, because you won't say to yourself, oh, I shouldn't be that way because they won't like me. Because you're in service to the teachings and you're in service to the students. So often it is what's needed is a little fire and a little harshness and some seriousness and some what you're calling tough love, like a parent. Because sometimes as a parent, we have to be harsh. We don't love the child any less when we're being harsh. But our concern is not that the child like me. Our concern is that the child mature.
Yeah, and they're learning.
And the child grows, the child learns, the child become a happy person, the child become a contributor in the world. You know, that is the reason behind it. So sometimes that calls for love and cuddles. And sometimes that calls for harshness and a little bit of an attitude that comes out as sort of severity. So I think the teacher will often adapt to what is needed in the moment. And sometimes that is harshness. But in my experience, the harshest teachers, if they're truly authentic teachers and they truly are agenda free, they're all love and mush on the inside. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't had a relationship with one long, you know, it would be maybe be a couple times that I might meet them. So I wouldn't get more than that.
Yeah. And I would say really, if you encounter a teacher who's only love and mush and cuddles and sweetness and never any fire, that would be concerning to me.
Right.
And on the other hand, if you encounter a teacher that is only harsh and only tough and there's no sense of love, that's also a concern, because the teacher sees the teachings as sacred, sees the student as sacred, and sees the role of teacher as sacred. And what their interest is that this, as I said, that the student grow.
And that is
love, right? Like a parent loves a child, the teacher has. So the student should feel, never should the student feel rejected in the presence of a teacher or not good enough or non-acceptable. You know, we feel that enough in our own minds. I'm not good enough. I'm unworthy. I'm not acceptable to myself. In the presence of the teacher, a student should always feel utterly acceptable and a presence of love and care, even if the teacher's being harsh. So we're looking for that. And as teachers, we're aspiring to that. No one who would call themselves a student of mine should feel a sense of rejection in my presence. That's kind of in my mind, the oath of anyone in the teacher position.
Mm-hmm. So let's take the track to now, say you found a teacher and they start giving you, a teacher for anything. Let's just say a teacher for anything. And you start getting information and you're like, ooh, this sits with me really well. Or, ooh, this doesn't sit with me very well. I have to think about this longer. Mm. How does one start to use discernment and self-thinking of the education that they're receiving, know if it's right for them? And how do you know where you need to just push over a hump? And we can talk about that after if you need to answer the first question first, but kind of that hump of like, ooh, it's too hard. Maybe this isn't right for me. Or, oh, this is too hard. Maybe I need to dig deeper.
Yeah. It's a great question. So, and it's an important part of the process. So first of all, it's a really good, that question really shines a light on the importance of finding a teacher that you can be in relationship with. So you might find a big guru who has thousands of students, and then you may be able to glean good teachings from them. But can you meet with them one-on-one? Do you have that opportunity? Can you bring your doubts to them? Can you bring your questions to them? Can you get what you would get out of a personal relationship? So this is a really, this question is a really good reminder to what I was saying before. It's not so much about the title. It's who can I find that I can not only resonate with, as I said before, but be in direct relationship with so that I can bring my doubts and my concerns and my questions to the table. So now let's say you're getting a teaching or a practice. You know, we have to differentiate a little bit because let's say it's like a yoga pose that you've been taught. Mm-hmm. If it hurts, you should not be doing it, in my opinion. So there's, right, if there's pain, then come out and say, there's pain, this hurts. And the teacher should be able to respond to that because we shouldn't be in pain, in my opinion, in my experience. Okay. Let's say it's a teaching and you're like, this doesn't, you feel a sense of rejection toward the teaching. This doesn't feel right to me, or this doesn't sound right to me. This doesn't fit my current understanding, or this seems a contradiction to something you said before or taught before. You know, there's a lot of different reasons why we could have a question or a doubt. Well, then, if you're not in immediate pain, like I was saying with the yoga pose, then you can write the question down or hold the question somewhere in your mind and then wait. Because often, if you stay with the teaching a little bit more, let's say you're in the middle of a class, the answer comes. There's more to be unfolded.
Yeah.
And this happens so much when I teach, say, the Bhagavad Gita. I'll pause for questions in the middle of the class, and students will ask all these questions. And I say, you know what? That's actually coming in the next segment of this class or in the next chapter of the Gita. You're tracking right along, the answer will come. Or the doubt, you know, they have, this doesn't make sense to me. I have a doubt about this, or this seems wrong. Say, yep. But the explanation that's going to make it make sense is it's coming. So sometimes wait. We're so agitated.
Yeah.
It makes us, you know, bring all the doubts up and all the questions up so quickly, and we want to fix it right away. And sometimes it's okay to wait. But sooner or later, you should have a forum, a conversation, an opportunity of some kind to bring your doubts and questions to the teacher, the mentor, the guru, whatever that person is in your life. You absolutely, that should be provided for by a teacher. In fact, it's inbuilt into the yoga tradition, into the teaching methodology that's been passed down through lineage, is that the teachings are supposed to be listened to. The student is meant to listen to the teachings and contemplate the teachings. And then the student is supposed to bring their doubts and questions to the teacher. And then the teacher helps resolve. Sometimes it's, well, the student is misunderstanding the teaching. Sometimes a student has a current construct in the mind, and this new teaching is threatening the current construct, and the current construct is the problem. Sometimes there's more to be unfolded. And then sometimes we have a teaching and a teacher that's problematic, and the student is starting to see that, right? So I don't want to discount that sometimes a student will say, this doesn't sound right, or this seems contradictory, or this, you're making this recommendation, but that's in contradiction to a teaching you gave. And so sometimes certain doubts and questions in the mind of the student may be shining light on the fact that the teacher is wrong. Mm-hmm. I just want to, you know, make that clear that, you know, not everybody who puts themselves in the position of teacher or takes on that title or claims to be able to teach something just because they put it on their website or on their social media, I teach these practices or I teach these texts, doesn't mean that they do have the authority to do so. So you should be able to bring your doubts and questions up so they can be resolved, so that you can get more help in a personal way, or so that you can see, you know what, something is amiss. So you listen to the teachings, you bring your questions up, and then you continue that process, contemplating the teachings further or going deeper or getting more out of it. Or, as I'm giving this little caveat, saying, you know what, something is amiss here, I'm going to move on.
So I guess sorting out, if you receive information from a teacher and it just, it goes so against what you have known and the information that you've received your entire life, and you almost have this severe reaction to it, do you think that's good? Like,
it's complicated.
It is complicated. Yeah.
Well, it's complicated because I have to know, I would have to know, well, what's the teaching and who's the teacher? Because, so let's say this. So I have had in my life a couple, one in particular teacher that was an unethical person who was what we would say, you know, to use Sanskrit, violating dharma, violating what is right. Taught some great, amazing practices and teachings, but then would go around and contradict those with psychological manipulation and so on. So sometimes the railing against what I'm hearing or seeing is, I'm seeing that this teacher is a problem. And that too, we have to sit with and witness and watch and go back to the teachings and say, yeah, this is, they're saying this and they're doing this, or they're teaching this and they're, you know, something is not right. And you sit with it and you say, is dharma being violated? Is harm being caused by this teaching or teacher? Then you've got to get out of there. Mm-hmm. So let's set that aside. Let's say that's not the case. Let's say what the case is, that you have a current viewpoint that you've cultivated over your lifetime, that you were taught by parents and by culture.
Yes.
And now you're receiving a teaching that seems in contradiction to that.
Or they've told themselves a story their whole life in their head, and now this contradicts that.
Yeah. So I'll give an example, because it's right in where what I've been teaching currently in my Bhagavad Gita program. So in the Vedanta viewpoint, which is the viewpoint that's taught in the Bhagavad Gita, which is this idea of oneness, one without a second. So there is only consciousness. This is also in Shaktism for those who follow like feminine divine teachings, same teaching. There is only the one, which is manifesting as many forms. So as part of that teaching, what you learn over time is that there is nothing that is non-divine. Now, this is very confusing and even an overwhelming teaching for people who have grown up their entire lives and been reinforced by culture, by society, by parents, by religion, that there are things that are divine and things that are non-divine, people that are good and people that are bad, right? So now I'm saying there is nothing that is not divine. Everything is an unfoldment of the same one presence or consciousness, right? And then there will always be lots of students say, but that can't be divine. And that can't be, because what about the people that are causing harm? What about the corporations and so on? So this is a very good question, and you should ask it. And then the teacher should be able to, over time, help the student to unpack, what is it that I'm railing against and why? What is it that I'm not really understanding about the teaching? And that takes time. If you think about, so we have to have patience, and we have to let the teacher do their thing, let the teachings do their thing. And the teacher should have the methods to help the student with that process. So I use methods, embodied methods and teaching methods, to help people step by step. For example, I say, well, you don't start this discovery by picking the most distasteful thing to you and trying to convince yourself that it's divine. That's not how this works. Start with the thing that's most lovable to you, most resonant, most easily adored by you. Start with that. And then we go through a teaching process, which I can't do here because it takes many hours, you know, over time. But there's contemplative processes and there's embodied practices and there's a means that we get to there. But this is just an example of a teaching that sort of hits the core of people's current construct. So part of the teaching that I might give there is, you know, you use the word divine to say ice cream is divine. You know, that's not what's meant here. We're talking about consciousness with a capital C. It's not about something being delicious and likable. So there's that's, you know, so the teacher gives metaphors like that, and the teacher gives practices with whatever the thing is that we are railing against. Another example is the teaching that you are utterly whole and worthy just as you are. And the student's mind and psychological construct is saying, there's no way that can be true. I know myself to be utterly incomplete, inadequate, and unworthy. And the teacher can't just keep repeating it. You're worthy, you're worthy, you're worthy. It doesn't work that way. That's just like beating something over someone's head. So the teacher has to have methodologies, and over time in relationship with the trust between teacher and student or mentor and student or whatever, that hardened construct gets deconstructed, softened, melted away, so that then ultimately the student discovers for themselves, I am utterly worthy. I am whole and complete as I am. But if you think, how many years have you been under the impression that you're unworthy and inadequate? Well, that's it's going to take a little time.
I'm thinking, are these teachings, and we're talking about yoga now, better to be experienced through the intellect brain or the heart, the feeling sense? I mean, I think a lot of it you do have to think about, right? There's like a lot of this intellect of the different ways that these, what they mean, but there's also like a felt experience of being whole and complete.
Yes. Yes. It has to be, the whole of you has to get on board. Your intellect, your discernment, your feelings, your emotions, your reactions, your heart, your history, your body, the whole of you has to be on board, and be, and the teacher should have methods that reach the whole of you. And this is another way to kind of discern a teacher who's going to help lift your suffering, because your suffering just isn't in your head. It isn't just at the intellectual level. So if you have a teacher that's purely academic, that's giving you lots of information, and it sounds really good and it's very quotable and so on, but is it changing you? If it's only getting to the intellect, it will not be transformational. It'll be transactional. And then you have teachers that can give you great experiences, sort of great felt sense experiences in the body, but there's no discernment on board. There's no intellect on board. That also won't be transformative. It'll be a cool experience.
Right.
You know, and then you can go to the bar and have a different kind of cool experience or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's really important, because I think that with our culture, we stay stuck in maybe the intellect brain, you know, the brain discernment, always going with what, overthinking. And then I think you have the other half of the population that just wants to feel or check out and feel something else. Yeah. So there's no in between of getting both.
Yeah, it's very, very true. We really need to bring all of it on board. In fact, the teaching that I just shared with students this week is this is in the Bhagavad Gita. It says, put your intellect and your emotions on the divine being or presence. And so it literally says this is in the Bhagavad Gita, because that's what I happen to be teaching presently. It is, put the whole of you in this. Not just your mind and not just feelings.
No, really. I feel like there's some people who are so disassociated and so disconnected that they aren't able to do that. Pick one or
the other. They're not able. You're right. So it's usually we start with one or the other. And this, again, this is over time to become an integrated person. You are integrated. They're not, there isn't really an actual separation between your head and heart or your body and your mind. But that is how we experience ourselves. We have disassociated ourselves. We have separated, and we've done it in order to stay safe or to feel okay. There are reasons why we do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get through life.
To survive. Exactly. And so we have to, we have to integrate. What we really have to do is we have to kind of peel away what is giving us the notion that we are a bunch of separate component parts when we really are not. And again, this is what yogic practice and teachings done in the authentic way, that is what they do. They will integrate you. So it's not like you could just tell yourself, well, I'm a whole person, or I'm going to bring my head and heart along for the ride. This is why the teachings have to be unpacked in a particular way, why you can't just sit down and read a text cover to cover, because it won't do that for you.
Right.
It will either stay in the intellect, or it'll go to, oh, these are really sweet, inspiring things that make me feel good when I read them. So then it'll just stay at that level.
Level, yeah.
And then there's yoga poses or other practices that you might do with your body. And those have to be also leaving an imprint on the whole of you, on the intellect, on the emotions, on, you know, the subtle. So these practices, when they are taught in the way they were designed, so not just the teachings and practices, but the teachings and practices delivered with particular methodologies, they themselves will integrate the student, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But again, it's over time, because again, think about how long have you been disassociating? So
I don't think people realize how much time that it takes to really delve in to anything, you know, to anything, not only yoga and its goals, but anything that they try to do, it does take time and lots of it and lots of effort.
It takes time. And of course we want a quick fix because we're suffering. We want a quick fix for everything, but think about anything, as you're saying, anything we want to accomplish that's valuable takes time.
Yeah.
Takes time. And so if we think about how long it takes a child to mature, it takes the whole of childhood and beyond.
And
here we are, you know, in our 40s and 50s, still going, I'm still maturing. So how long does it take to mature? And that's what the spiritual quest is. That's what the human life quest is. It's a quest of maturation. So it's ongoing. You're never done. You're never done. My own teachers and mentors, they had teachers and mentors.
No, it's true. We're never
done. We're never done. We're never, you know. And yet, along the way, you are growing and changing, and you are more and more in recognition of the wholeness that you are. And so though, for example, I am always still working with my own mentors and teachers and the teachings and applying it all and so on, I will say that I'm no longer coming to that with a sense of inadequacy the way that I was 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
because the teachings have transformed me. But I'm still returning to them because the thing is that the student over time experiences that the practice and the teachings are nectar, and we just keep wanting more.
We do keep wanting more. I mean, that's good. I think knowledge seeking is extremely important. It's what drives me. It's what drives me to be a better person. So knowledge seeking, I think, is extremely important. And yeah, calling it nectar is...
It's so delicious. I cannot get enough. I want more.
So sweet.
But then we also have discernment on board. So it's, we go, okay, but what do I want? And what's really going to, you know, be in service of my growth? And what really will best suit me, and so on. And so we also don't have to be like desperately grabbing at every, you know, program and teacher. And, you know, we bring discernment with us and go, this is what's a fit for me.
Well, I guess let's take a little kind of swerve into that next topic is what about the people who jump from thing to thing to thing to thing? When we say that we need to give it time, do you think it's detrimental to keep digging these little holes everywhere of little things?
I do. I think it can be detrimental, like actually cause harm to the student. And it also is a way for the student to kind of protect themselves from, you know, to block the growth and the maturation and the healing that they're really seeking. You know, it's sort of like jumping from partner to partner to partner to partner. You can have a lot of cool experiences and interactions, but will you go deep the way that you will if you, and this could be a friendship as well. You could have, you know, 50 friends and you see a different friend every day or every week or whatever, or you could have, you know, 3 friends that you go deep with over time and you're friends for decades. And what is the difference between a friendship or a partnership or relationship that you have for decades versus, you know, someone that you spent a few hours with once? It's completely different. It's not even comparable.
And then you're talking about the relationship between a teaching.
The relationship between a teaching.
If you go deep into that one thing
with the teaching,
many other.
Yes. I mean, I'm about the teacher as well. So, you know, when I'm with a teacher, then I just study whatever they're teaching. So if they say, this is what we're learning now, I say, okay. Because I've vetted the teacher. I've investigated the teacher. I've spent time with the teacher. Once I'm on board with a teacher or a mentor and I trust them, then what they're teaching is what I'm interested in because of that trust. So it's the same with, let's say, something like a mantra practice. The student should not be going to the teacher and saying, give me this mantra. I Googled it and I want to learn this mantra. Teach it to me. Initiate me. And there's a no. The student is just saying, this is what I'm suffering with. And then sometimes the teacher will say, well, then in that case, do this kind of asana practice, or let's do this teaching, or here's a mantra. The teacher discerns. As you said, as we talked about before, the student doesn't know what the underlying cause is or what the real root of the problem is or what the best remedy is. The teacher is there with the remedies for your life. And, you know, for me, for example, I will use astrological configurations to help discern what I'm going to teach next, because that will help kind of be in service to what the students will be suffering with. Mm-hmm. I use understanding who my students are because I'm in relationship with my students, some more intimately than others because they've been with me for longer or because they speak up more frequently. But I'm really listening and getting to know who are the kinds of people that are drawn to study with me? What are they suffering with? Mm-hmm. And so I'm selecting what I'm teaching, whether it's yoga or mantra or a text, based on who the students are. And what's happening, you know, in the environment, meaning in my case, I'm using astrological configurations to kind of choose. So there's a reason why something would be taught by a teacher, and we sort of need to trust that.
Agree. I do that as soon as I know the day I'm teaching and what I'm teaching. It's like, what's going on outside? What's going on in the world? What am I seeing with the people as they're walking into class?
So that things are on purpose for this. The teacher needs to be on purpose, and then the student will benefit. And that's also the thing about, as you said, you know, digging a bunch of holes versus digging a well. And there's lots of different stories from different traditions that, you know, about digging a well versus, you know, you dig 20 feet in the ground, you hit water. You dig 21 foot holes in the ground, you don't get to water. Exactly. So we dig deep with a teacher once we know that they are appropriate for us and so on. And then we just trust.
Yeah. Love that. Can you just explain for the people that don't know what dharma is? And sometimes they'll hear it as dharma.
Yes, dharma.
Just a quick explanation for the people that don't know what that is.
Sure. Quick is difficult, but I'll do my best. Okay. Dharma is a big topic.
It is a very big topic.
So I will do a little soundbite as much as I can. So to understand dharma, we actually first have to have another Sanskrit word, which is rita. So rita, R-T-A, to put it in English, rita means natural order, or we can even say cosmic order. It's not something that we create. It is what can be discovered about the nature of existence. So the seasons, the movement of the planets, and the way that the body functions, you know, the cellular level and gravity and every aspect of existence we can call Rita, natural order or cosmic order. Okay. So dharma means that which upholds cosmic order or natural order. So that's at every level, what upholds nature, what upholds the body. So the nature of the body, for example, the cosmic order of the human body is to be sleeping when it's nighttime and awake during the day. So to stay up all night and sleep all day, we can say this is a violation of dharma. So dharma is that which upholds cosmic order or natural order. And then we can take it at a universal level. So at a universal level, universal dharma, at the simplest level, means no unnecessary harm, no unnecessary violation of the order. That's universal dharma. And then there's personal dharma, which is how a lot of people in the yoga world hear my dharma. What's my dharma? So they mean, what's my purpose? So it's called sva, which means the person essentially. Self, dharma, swadharma, is your, what role are you here to personally play to uphold that order? Mm. And that's one's own dharma. And sometimes what you're here to do is wash the dishes or change a diaper. You know, so your own personal dharma, it goes from everything at the mundane level, day-to-day responsibilities, religious responsibilities for those that are in a religion, you know, and all the way to kind of that deep question that a lot of people are asking, but what am I here to do really? Mm. That is also swadharma. And there we can look to what is the person built for? What are they actually here for? What is it that's intrinsically you in everything that you're doing? And how can you really step into that fully in your life to participate in the upholding of the natural order in the way that you, as a unique individual, is that the way that you are designed to do, why you're here as part of this whole thing. So that's
a great explanation. Dharma. Great explanation. Wow.
Oh, good. Maybe dharma is, that's my thing. This is, if there's one thing that I've focused on in everything that I do, it is dharma.
Well, I've been asking this year or this season, what do you think the meaning of life is? And I think it's dharma, mm. Right? I think you just explained it so well.
It's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Unless you have another meaning of life.
Well, that's right. I think we would all have a different answer because we're each in a different life. I don't think there's one right answer to that question. The meaning of life or the purpose of life?
To you. Either one you want to answer.
Well, I'm going to take these words from one of my teachers. He would say the purpose of life is to grow.
Mm. I love that. I agree.
And how we grow should be in accord with dharma. I'll add that. Okay. Because if you think of a plant growing, if dharma is violated, the sun doesn't shine, the rain doesn't fall, the soil is not nourished, that means dharma is violated, then the plant doesn't grow. Right. So the purpose of life is to grow. And the only way to grow is to be in accord with dharma. Mm-hmm.
Kaya, thank you so much for this. This flew by. I feel like we could talk about so many more things. You have a lot of great information about a lot of different topics. So maybe we can have you back for one of those again. I appreciate you taking time out for this. I know that you're super busy as a mom and teacher and homeschooler. So I appreciate it.
Well, I think it flew by too. It was really such a pleasure. I love the questions and I'll come back anytime.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. I do hope that you found this podcast helpful and that there's something that you can take away from it that will really improve your life physically, mentally, and emotionally. I do these free of cost for you all.
and hope that it's a good resource for you. If you are looking for anything Ohana related, feel free to check out our website, ohanayoganh.com. Thank you and have a beautiful day.